And now it is my pleasure to introduce our speaker, Derek. I have known him since I've gotten sober. I know bits and pieces of his story. He is one of those that when he shares, you kind of listen a little bit more, you pay attention a little bit more just because of his experience, and plus he's an amazing man. So I give you Derek.
I'm Derek. I'm an alcoholic.
Hey,
most people don't talk that well about me. Thank you. Yeah, I've been knowing Kat for quite a while since she got sober, and we both share the same home group. I got sober December 8th, 1979. It was a hell of an eye opener for me. But first, I want to tell you guys, I've been having some dark days here lately, so I kind of want to get that out the way because I'm a little nervous about it, and I know if it comes up a little bit later on, I may lose my composure. I celebrated my birthday in December, so I got sober in Los Angeles. So every year, I go out to L.A. to celebrate my anniversary. This year was no different. But what was different, when I got back, I came back on December the 11th, and as I was leaving the airport, my attorney called me. And she told me that all your partners got arrested today, and they're looking for you. And I said, oh, shit, that wasn't good news. I had to call my sponsor. Because a lot of things jumped off, you know. Fear, my anxiety level went way up. My concern about my freedom kicked in. And it's not because I've never been to jail. I've been to jail many times, but not in a long time. So, you know, I went to Florida. This is in Florida. I lived down there part-time. So I went to Florida, turn myself in. Now, that's not normal behavior for me, to turn myself in to the police. I can't remember a time that I was wanted for something that I did go and turn myself in. I always ran. You know, I never faced the problem. So I did. You know, I went down there, you know, turned myself in. I stayed in jail for about a week. I went in on a Sunday and I got out on a Sunday. And I got out Sunday night about midnight. My partner that picked me up, he said, man, you need to call your brother. So I said, okay, well, you know, I'll call him, you know. So I called my brother and he said, hey, man, mom died. That was devastating. Not just that she had died, but I wasn't there. You know, I was locked up. You know, my mom meant everything to me. She was 95 years old. So now I got some guilt running rampant, trying to take on some responsibility as though me being in jail had something to do with her dying. And it's amazing how my brain will go different places even though I've been, you know, sober as long as I have, you know. It went there. I hadn't thought about taking a drink in a long time, but that was one of them times, you know, because I really felt it. And I still do. I miss my mom. I'm trying not to get misty on you guys. Moving forward, about 3 weeks ago, my brother called me and said, man, our sister died. I got a baby sister. Well, I had a baby sister. She's 6 years younger than me. And man, see, I started thinking about not the good things, but the times I hadn't been there for my mom or for my sister. Once again, you know, I had to make that phone call. So it's been kind of dark here the last few months. So I guess it's probably good that Kat called me and asked me to do this so I can get it out there. See, I never disclosed it at a meeting yet, you know, because I didn't want y'all to think ill of me. But I learned when I initially came to the fellowship that this is where all the shit happens, right here at this podium. And it's what I do with the shit that I'm holding on to that is going to determine whether I stay here or not. So, now that I said all that, we'll get past that part. I was in jail. This was 1976. I've been in there for a couple of years. When they released me, I know some, none of you probably been to jail, but you have to go see your parole officer. So, you know, I went to see my parole officer, and he told me I was going to have to, you know, come in and report. And I was going to be on testing where I would have to, you know, call this number, have to go do a urinalysis. And I didn't think that was going to work out too well for me. Because, you know, I had been locked up for a while, and, you know, I like to do other shit other than drink. And it had been a long time. So I was kind of waiting on that day to get out so I could do my thing. He said, yeah, you're going to be on test. And he said, I'm going to tell you this, that if you bring me one dirty test, you're going to be going back to prison to be Bubba's wife. That was a hell of a vision for me. I just couldn't see that. That was a horrible thing somebody could say to me. Because, you know, I could actually see it happening. You know? He did me a favor. He said, I'm going to do you a favor. And he handed me this pamphlet. He said, I suggest that you go to these meetings. And I was like, oh, okay. So I went to this meeting that night. It was a Monday. It was at a place called the Unitarian Church in North Hollywood. And when I walked up into the parking lot, it was, to me now, it was 100 Harley Davidsons in the parking lot. I was already questioning what the hell going to a meeting was going to do for me. I mean, how is that going to affect my desire to use? Because I'm a dope fiend. I'm a use. You know, that's what I did. So anyway, I'm, you know, looking at the differences, and I go in the meeting. I mean, literally, I'm like, what? Is nobody in there that looks like me. And my head, once again, you know, attacked me. But lo and behold, you know, God put this one black guy, and he was way on the other side of the room. And boy, I was so happy to see his ass. Now, you know, I ran over there to that dude. I know I probably shocked the shit out of him. You know, hey, what's happening, bro? And he said, hi, my name is David. And I was like, God. Brother undercover. David ended up being a good friend of mine. He's still sober today. That's the good news. Bad news is I couldn't stay. You know, I had to go do some more research. And consequently, you know, during that research period, I was calling that number. And, you know, and guess what? My number came up. Here I go. I ain't going to turn myself in. Ain't no need me going and seeing them because I'm going to jail. So I went on the run. I had met this guy while I was going to meetings. His name was Bill Hayward. Me and Bill, you know, we used to talk quite a bit. I never asked him to be my sponsor, but I kind of was trying to slide up under him undercover, you know, and eventually get up enough nuts, you know, to ask him. So I told Bill what was going on. He said, look, man, why don't you go over to this treatment center? I got a partner of mine over there that will help you. And I said, man, they're going to make me turn myself in. And he said, no, not right away. But they'll help you out. I was like, what the hell? So December the 7th, you know, 1979, I went to that treatment center. And that's why my sobriety date is December the 8th. But I went in there, and the first day I was there, they were having this big group meeting. It was 39 guys in this treatment center. The counselor was telling everybody, you know, some things about the program. And he was saying, he said, look, it's 39 of you guys that are in here. Out of the 39 guys that are in here, only 3 of you guys are going to complete this program. I was like, what the hell? And he said, out of two of you guys, only going to stay sober 5 years. Okay. And only one of you guys is going to stay sober 10. And that mother was looking straight at me. And I got a resentment. He like telling me I ain't gonna be the one. So I stayed there for a long time on a resentment, saying, you know, I'm gonna show his ass. Yeah, I'm gonna be the one. I stayed in that program for 13 months. There were three of us that completed the program. When I celebrated 5 years, only one of the other guys showed up. When I celebrated 10, I was the only one there. I guess what he was saying meant something. The statistics of us alcoholics surviving without a drink is slim. But when I look around this room and I see how many people are here and many other rooms that I've been to, it lets me know that it's still working. You know, sometimes I can't see it's working in me, or gauging it by what I see my progress might be. But when I go to meetings, something kind of reverses that mindset that I have. And although I haven't drank in a long time, I at times still think I'm a piece of shit. And I've had many joyful times here in the rooms, and I've had some not so joyful times. But all in all, you know, it's been a hell of a trip. You know, this has been a hell of a journey. So while I was in this treatment center, he instructed me to go to a particular meeting on Thursday night. And on Thursday night, there was an NA meeting that all the guys, we all caught the bus to this NA meeting. But I said, Frank, we go. And he said, no, you're not going over there. You're going where I told you to go. I was like, oh, shit. So I was walking over to the meeting, and the meeting is at the federal building. And I was like, oh, shit. I know I ain't got no business in no federal building. You know, we don't see eye to eye. And the name of the group was Clancy's Clan. Oh, shit. Now, I know this is a bad decision here. I see some of y'all know Clancy's Clan. It's the biggest AA meeting in Los Angeles. 200-300 people strong every Thursday. So, you know, I get over there to the federal building, and, you know, because I'm walking in this, you know, a good 20-minute walk or so from where the treatment center was, my mind had an adequate amount of time to catch up with me and tell me all the reasons that this ain't gonna work. And I walked in there, and it seemed like a sea of people. I mean, I couldn't see faces, but I could see all these guys and ladies. And those of you that maybe know something about Clancy's Clan, they dress up. You know, all the men wear suits and sport coats. No facial hair. And all the women had on nice, pretty dresses. And, you know, back in 1979, I didn't quite look like I look now. I didn't really walk, you know, like I walk now. I had a big old natural, and I walked with a limp, you know, because that's what cool mothers do. And man, that was an experience. That was the first AA meeting I had ever been to. I'm sitting in there, and they're reading the literature, and they're reading out the book, and they're talking about alcohol, and ain't nothing but white people. I was real prejudiced back then. You know, y'all probably don't believe that, but I was. Because in my mind, you know, I had never had good experiences with white people. You know, y'all called me shit like nigga, you know, boy. And I had been in the service for some years before that. And they didn't treat blacks quite well back in them days. So my experience was really tainted, you know. And that ain't to say that I didn't meet some of y'all that was pretty cool, because I got high with you motherfuckers. But once again, you know, my mind is looking at the differences. See, I no longer can see any similarities in the adventure that I'm on. I can only see the differences. So when I see you guys, I wasn't seeing people. I was looking at the differences. They were dressed up nice, and I had on probably the only clothes I owned. They talk real, you know, proper. You know, I talk like I was still in the street. And I sat there, and as they read about alcohol, it took everything in my power to keep me in that seat. See, because I thought being a dope fiend was a cut above. You know, I was cool. And I got to tell you, my dad had three brothers and three sisters, and they were all alcoholics. Except my dad. My dad was a cop. I know you laughing, because I look like the cop's kid. That kind of shit you do, right? Cops and PK kids. But I survived the meeting. I really did. I was able to keep my butt in the seat, but I couldn't wait to get out of there. You know, a couple guys came over to me and tried to say something, and I tried to hurry up and end that conversation. I got to get the hell out of here, and I got a few choice words for Frank's ass when I get back to the trees. How dare him send me over here to this place? So I talked to Frank the next day and told him I wasn't going back over there anymore, and you know, I wasn't like you people, you know. And he said, okay, that's fine, D. You don't want to go back over there no more. Yeah, shit, I want to go with the other brothers. He said, okay, pack your shit then and go on with them. And I was like, whoa. I didn't think it was going to get that serious. See, I can't leave, because if I leave, they're going to tell the court that I left, and I'm going to go to jail. So once again, see, my life is being controlled by fear. Fear of what's going to happen. Fear of my inadequacies to do what's necessary for me to keep my ass in this treatment center until my commitment is up. So every Thursday, you know, I went to Clancy's Clan. Probably had been going for a few weeks, and these guys came up, because I would always come and then meet no, I'd be gone. These guys came up to me and said, hey man, we're going to Polly's Pie House. Would you like to go? And I was like, you know, I ain't had no money. I had got some clothes out of the indigent locker, so I looked a little better than I did when I first started going there. But I ain't had no money. They ain't going to like me. Then they're going to tell everybody else that nigga ain't had no money. But they convinced me to go. They even offered to give me a ride back to the treatment center. And I was like, these mother up to something. They want something. Now, I ain't got shit. But they want something. So they gave me a ride back to the treatment center. And I was so overwhelmed with gratitude. Because I see, this guy didn't have to do that. They even paid for my damn food. And didn't ask me for nothing. I mean, they just like, can't stand to pay. You know, they just stroked the money on out there. I was like, damn, who do that? They don't know me. And the guy dropped me off and he got out of his car. He came around to me. He said, man, Derek, man, I'm glad you're here, bro. And anything you need, just let me know. And he hugged me. And I started crying. because this was something I hadn't felt in a long time. And I continued to go to Clancy's Clan. Then one day, some months later, Frank told me, hey man, D, you can go to the NA meeting with the other brothers. Go ahead. And I thought about it for a second. I said, you know what? I'm going to my meeting. And I went back to Clancy's Clan. See, by then, I had started recognizing that I had a problem with alcohol. Although that was not my primary drug when I was out there in the street, I started drinking before I did anything else. And when I drank till I couldn't drink no more, till it was gone, I couldn't stop, you know. So I think I kind of got the lesson of why Frank sent me over there. See, I had to learn that I'm an alcoholic. No matter how much of a other substance I've ever used in my life, the bottom line is I'm an alcoholic and I'm right where I'm supposed to be. So when I go home, I always still call L.A. home, although I haven't lived there in over 30 years. I go over there to Clancy's Clan. You know, and it didn't hurt that there was this pretty girl at me. You know, that helped too, this chick named Patricia. Yeah, that kind of helped me stick around. It's a program of attraction, right? I think it say that somewhere in our literature. So anyway, I'm going to share this experience with you guys in hopes that it will kind of give you a little insight after, I think I had been in there for about 9 months. I had made a friend with this guy named White Guy. Huh, go figure that. And his name was Ray Horsky. How much more white could you be, Ray Horsky? But me and Ray were real good friends. We were talking one day, and I said, Ray, you know what, we've been here for, you know, a long time, man. There's no girls in the treatment center, so, you know, we couldn't get no nookie. You know? And, you know, I don't know about y'all, but after 9 months, you know, nookie go way up on the priority list. So I said, Ray, let's get out of here, man. You know, let's go have some fun. He's like, oh, okay, D, no problem, yeah. So we discussed it, you know, we were going to make our great escape. We're going to tie some sheets together. We're on the third floor, and we're going to throw them out the window, and we're going to climb down, and we're going to make our great escape. Frank called up to the treatment center. It was on a Saturday. He called the treatment center. He told him to go get me. And he said, hey, there's a guy coming in there today. His name is Jerry Jenkins. I want you to be his big brother. Shit, it's gonna fuck up my plan. Because I don't know, I know some people here from the treatment center, but as a big brother, I have to stay with Jerry. I cannot go anywhere without Jerry with me. And it's my responsibility to tell Jerry how this has changed my life. Jerry, don't leave 5 seconds before a miracle. You know, stick around. You know all the good shit we're supposed to tell people. You know? And so when Ray came to get me that night, I said, hey, Ray, check this out. Let's go tomorrow. And he said, okay, D, no problem. And we got up the next day, and Ray was gone. And I was like, oh, shit. Ray left me. I thought that was very messed up, you know, because I could only think about what Ray was doing, because Nookie was, you know, that was the real culprit, the purpose for leaving. A couple days later, my Frank, my counselor, he called, told the guys, hey, go get, I ain't going to tell y'all what he called me, but go get him. I said, oh, man, Ray done called and snitched on me. So I went to Frank's office, and Frank was like, okay, you know, sit your ass down. said, I want to let you know that Ray's wife called me. And I was like, oh. Ray's dead. And I said, boy, glad I wasn't with Ray. See, there's some things that has happened over the period of time that I had been there that had changed. One of those things was that my desire to use or drink was not like it was when I first got there. See, I thought about that shit every day for months. You know, I thought like a lot of y'all probably thinking now, shoot, I'm going to get my weight on, get looking a little better, and off to the races, my friend Ray. God doing for me what I couldn't do for myself. Because, see, I was supposed to be with Ray. We was going to make our great escape from a treatment center. Do they lock y'all in there? I don't think the doors are locked, are you? Can you leave anytime you want to?
Yep.
Don't say anything. Make my escape. Now, I don't know where that came from. To really, truly escape from the treatment center. But that's my twisted mind. I was walking down the hall one day. Once again, here go Frank. Bring your ass here, man. Come here. I said, what's going on? He said, what you still doing there? I was like, what the heck he talking about? He said, yeah, what you still doing here? And you know, we call each other, nigga, y'all can't do it, though. I'm going to let y'all know that now. But anyway, Frank says, asked me what you still doing here. I said, I don't know. What am I supposed to be doing, Frank? He said, well, your court commitment to be here was up 2 months ago. I just knew your ass be gone. And I was like, wow. I had stopped counting. I didn't want to leave no more. I was okay with being there. That was the first time I realized that something had changed in me. And that's what this program has done, you know. It changed me not from the outside in, but from the inside out. You know, I completed that program. I did my first 4 steps in there. I wrote an inventory. I'm going to tell you about Bill. I asked Bill to be my sponsor while I was in there. And Bill had told me when we first met that when he came to the fellowship, he was illiterate. He couldn't read or write. So I figured that'd be a good person to be my sponsor. Because if I'm going to tell some shit and write it down, it's best that he not be able to read it. So, you know, when it came time for me to share my inventory with Bill, I went over his house, and I had all this, you know, this stuff I had wrote down and everything, and popped it out. And I said, so you want me to read it to you? He said, no, let me see it. So he took it. And he started looking at it. And he laughed about something. And he read something else and he laughed about it. I'm like, whoa, what's going on? See, Bill didn't tell me that he had went to school since he had been in the fellowship. And he could read and write. Right? Ain't no way in hell I'd have read all that shit on there if I didn't know him Bill could read. Because, you know, he sent me out down the inventory, right? A couple of y'all? You know, that's you know what you do with that. You know, you expose it, you know. Don't leave nothing out. You know, tell all. And one more time, I realized God was doing for me what I couldn't do for myself. Because I didn't leave anything out. Because Bill couldn't read. And my plan was when I read it to him, just to skip over some shit. It didn't say, you know, when I did my fifth, that, you know, I had to tell everything because they had already told it in the fourth. The miraculous thing about this program is that in spite of my thinking, God always seems to pull me out of the mess and set me on a path. The problem is I get off the path. And when I get off the path, it's those steps on the wall that I have to use to get me back on the path. I don't think it says anything in the big book that says that once I get started, I'll never veer to the left. Shit, I'm always, 90% of the time, I'm either far left or far right. And thank God, when I'm going from one side to the other, I get to stay in the middle sometimes. And those are the times that are most peaceful, when I'm in the middle. I've had a lot of joyful times, you know, since I've been in this fellowship. A lot. It's been a lot of painful times also. Just 2 weeks ago, I was on the beach. You know, I live in Jacksonville, Florida, part of the time. The day after my sister died. And I went to the beach, and I was sitting on the beach, and I was looking out at the ocean. And I was trying to make some sense out of the shit that had been happening. You know, I was trying to make sense out of it, you know. And out of nowhere, the thought came that it was sure as hot. I'm in my feelings, and the feelings aren't good. This would be a nice time to take a drink. I want to tell you, it took a lot. It took a lot for me to sit there. Probably said the serenity prayer a million times. Thank God for that serenity prayer. To just keep me on the beach until this passes. Pain is a motivator. Thank God I didn't give in to the pain. Thank God I've done some things since I've been here that have allowed me to have a choice. And I just haven't chose to use. Now, surely enough, I didn't want to come in here and tell you guys I got 45 years sober and I was thinking about taking a drink. And that is literally the first time that that thought has ever come to me. And I've had some other issues where I could have, well, I was in enough pain that a drink could be optional. And the thought never came. This time, you know, and Bill used to tell me, he said, Derek, there'll come a time. And the time that you're here, that something will happen in your life that will make you think about taking a drink. Something's going to happen. So, you better start doing something now. I could call it putting something in the bank. So when that thought comes, you'll have a defense to say, thanks for sharing, but no thanks. You know, there are many people that have been in my life since I've been sober that have given me exactly what I needed to keep staying here one more day. My sponsor, I was just in this room maybe a couple months ago. My sponsor is, some of y'all may know, Chet G. He was celebrating his 47th birthday, and I was here visiting. Well, shit, I live here, but I was back up from Florida. He said, hey, D, why don't you meet me over at this meeting? And I came over here, and I seen him get his chip. And it was a very emotional time for me. You know, I may look like I'm a pretty tough guy, but I'm really, you know, I'm really not. I don't know why it was so emotional to see him get that chip. I think it was because I knew he cared enough about me. And he knew what I had been going through. And he wanted to give me some hope. And I don't just think that that's what the shot is here. I know it. I believe it. Without hope, I would have been long gone. You know, this program has definitely changed that little boy from Detroit into just a little man in Georgia. I share this with you guys and let it go. I have two older brothers, and my brother that I did a lot of street stuff with came up to the treatment center while I was up there. And I called him and said, man, come on up here. You know, this is about the time the transition was kind of happening with me where I wasn't concerned about, you know, the street anymore. Now I'm realizing that this thing is kind of doing something and it's working and I'm seeing something different and I wanted to share it with you. And he came up to the treatment center, and when I went out to meet him, he got out of the car and he had a tall can of Slitz Malt Liquor full. And I looked at him, boy, I was like, this mother, what is he thinking about? And I told him, I said, bro, you can't bring that shit up here. What's wrong with you? That's why I'm here. I'm trying to stay away from him. So I proceeded to tell him, bro, this is, you know, I found it, bro. This is what we've been looking for. Because me and my brother, we had been struggling for years. You know, we're in the service together and doing a bunch of, you know, crazy shit. And that's where I learned to drink at. This is what we need, bro. You need to come on and join us. And he said, we people like y'all need this. I don't need this. I can quit anytime I want to. And I knew then that my relationship with my brother had changed. Until I seen him in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, I knew things weren't going to be the same. Bad news. Good news. 2 years later, my brother called me one day. He said, hey man, can you get me in that treatment center? They had told me that I didn't have to do anything else. I had already told him. He knew where I was. He knew what was going on. He said, just keep your damn mouth shut and be an example. That's how you're getting. So at some point, the God in me touch the God in him. And he made that call. I was so happy. My big brother. And I know some of you probably got family members that you would love to see them sitting next to you. And I can tell you it's worth it. Pray for them. The feeling you get is indescribable. I cared more about him being here than I cared about me. Man, I've enjoyed you guys. I hope I was able to say something to allow you to get a little closer to me. And in hopes that something that I had, that I said, that you could identify with, will allow you to stay in that treatment center. And if you're not in the treatment center, that it will allow you to stay here and get one more day sober. Thank you guys for listening.
First I slipped, and then I tripped to a hope-filled dream. You rescued me, and finally, waking there I see. I look into love's window for a soul that's meant for me. Takes me where the promise is, all is. Sometimes quickly, sometimes slow, we get just what we need. On a broad highway, God won't die, we walk eternally. Look into love's window for a heart that beats for me. Takes me where the promises are in. And I always long for something that sets me free. Take me where the promises are.